Hi, and thanks for taking the time to download another podcast from the Cloud Evangelist website. My name is Richard Morrell. It's been an eventful week this week. I've been over in Lisbon in Portugal. I went over to Lisbon to give a keynote at Evento Linux 2012, and it's the 10th time these guys have put together this conference. A very slick, very well-oiled machine, very, very well-attended. Possibly one of the best-attended open source conferences I've been to in the last 12 or 13 years. So a big shout out to those guys for putting so much hard work and effort into it, and also our PR handlers who look after me brilliantly. So I was over there as part of a group of people, including Matt Essay, to talk about open source, to talk about cloud, to talk about all the cool innovative stuff that comes out of the open source community. And the room generally was made up of a lot of graduates and undergraduates and students who are obviously trying to find their feet, understanding where IT is going to take them and their specific careers. But a lot of companies involved in startup, a lot of companies who deal with small to medium-sized enterprise organizations. So the typical fodder which the open source community is very good at turning into our foot soldiers. So as well as sitting down and talking to customers this week about Linux and open source and talking to our distributors and our reseller partners, which is always good fun, it gave me the ability to stand up on stage and talk with passion about something that affects me and has given me a life, and that's open source. So without further ado, here's the talk that I gave yesterday. It's about half an hour long. I hope you find it both educational and entertaining. Normal service will be resumed next week when we've got some really good podcasts for you to come back to. Again, thanks for taking the time to download it. Speak to you guys soon. Okay, so my name's Richard Morrell. I work for Red Hat in North America. I'm based out of the UK covering Europe, but I'm a North American employee. And I've been involved with open source now for nearly 16 years. So my job title, I'm the cloud evangelist at Red Hat. I talk to organizations and governments, institutions, channel partners, resellers, about what we're doing in cloud, and also trying to curtail sometimes their ambition as they try to move to cloud too aggressively, or to try and assist them to get there safely. I also work in community outreach. As I said, I've been involved with open source since 1996, 1997. I founded Europe's first ever open source company in 1996. Europe's first ever Linux cluster was deployed on the Channel Tunnel project in Kent in the UK. So that was the first time Linux had been used anywhere in Europe for any form of commercial business traffic. And I went to work in San Francisco at a company called LinuxCare, which was one of the first ever dot-com companies who were involved in the chasing dot-com money, investor money, to turn it into a Linux services company. And they had the global vision that they could provide services and functionality to companies who would one day start taking this poster child baby Linux and deploying it into data centers. But as Matt pointed out, the way Linux got into the data center originally was through the back door. The first thing the CIO knew about Linux was when someone would come up to him and say that they'd tried to deploy a Windows NT patch on a box of servers, only to find out they were running Linux and Samba. They weren't actually running Windows NT. The administrators had deployed Linux. So he was the last person to know that he had Linux in his environment. And I saw that happen at Ford, at Goldman Sachs, at Jaguar, where the management didn't know they had Linux until Linux might maybe been there for a year, 18 months. I started work with LinuxCare in San Francisco for four ambitious guys, Dave LeDuc, Dave Siffrey, Art Tide, and a guy called Chris DeBona, who's now the head of community at Google. And very quickly, I worked on projects including the Cobalt Cube and the Cobalt Rack, which some of you may remember, the first ever real consumer Linux products. So I helped do a lot of the port from MIPS to Intel before Sun acquired Cobalt. And then I joined another startup called VA Linux in San Francisco, in Fremont. And they had some really cool ideas about spending money post-IPO on ThinkGeek and Slashdot and Freshmeat and Andover.net. And I worked for a guy called Tim Perdue, who sadly died a few years ago, or died last year. He was the founder of SourceForge. SourceForge was this idea of having a code repository where people could FTP their code, and they could set permissions, and they could set the ability to use Subversion to push code into a source code tree so that people all around the world could actually work on it. So it was a new dawn, and it was a new way of working. And VA had countless amounts of money to be able to go to Linux World Expos in Frankfurt and Tokyo and Paris. And I used to spend my time doing booth duty
with hired booth babes from Lufthansa we bring on stage just to give people beer. It was a great time to be involved in open source. Money ran freely like gold. And it was one of those times when open source had this ambition that it was going to run faster than it was capable of doing. And you saw a lot of companies go to the wall. You saw lots of companies acquired, Caldera acquired by SCO, VA Linux eventually disappear, apart from in Japan, where it's actually still trading today. And the only company that was left standing was Red Hat. So eventually, I was going to work for them at some point after I'd already turned down the ability to work day one. And it's bizarre. I work for Red Hat Europe on a daily basis, and Red Hat Europe has 2,400 staff. But when I first engaged with Red Hat, they had no staff in Europe. In fact, one guy, Colin Tenwick, and I used to do all his support for him. So I've been around Red Hat since before Red Hat had an office. So I'm the old man of Red Hat in Europe. And I'm only 40, so you know I don't know what that makes me. I sometimes wander into the Red Hat labs in the UK and in Brno and other locations. And I feel very old when the average age is 23, 24. And it's great seeing people here in the room who are of an age where your ambition and your drive and your focus can open doors for you. And I compel you, if you're not already involved with open source, to start thinking about getting involved with open source projects, even if it's just reading forums or posting to BugTrack or trying to get a focus around a feature that you want implemented that you may not know how to code, but you know how to test that code when that code is released by whoever commits it. So although my story with Red Hat is one of enterprise and working with institutions and corporations, I've also run an open source project. When I was at VA Linux, I founded a thing called Smoothwall. Has anyone heard of Smoothwall? It's a Linux firewall. And it was a project I started in a back bedroom. And there were two of us who started the project, and it was on SourceForge. And for 4 months, it was SourceForge's number one project with number one downloads. And when VA Linux tanked and ran out of money, it became my job. I turned the GPL project into a company. It proves that you can work sensibly. And unfortunately, it does take 18 hours a day. I had my partner and I had our first child last year. Because I've been concentrating on open source for 15 years, I've only just got around to having my first child. So this is my latest release, if you will. I have a child called Christopher. You know, one day I want to be able to sit him down and explain to him how daddy wrote software and gave it away for free without him laughing at me and thinking that his dad's a commercial nutcase. So, as I said, I get involved with community liaison, but my passion for the last 10 or 12 years has been around security. I took time out of open source in 2005. I worked at Smoothwall, and I sold Smoothwall, and I made my money. I'd do some other cool stuff, and I wouldn't go back to work because I was 31, and I thought, I don't need the money. I'll just stay at home and order stuff off eBay. And it got to an extent where the people next door thought I was a drug dealer because all that would happen every day would boxes would arrive from couriers. No one would see me, but boxes would arrive from nameless, faceless couriers from all over the world. So the assumption was I was selling cocaine or something. I got involved with security through the Smoothwall firewall. I got a phone call one day from a man at Virgin who said, would you like to come to a hotel with me? I've been asked a lot of strange things, but a man phoning me, asking me to go to a hotel with him, sounded dubious, but I needed to know more. And Virgin have a major internet service provider in the UK, 7 million customers, 7 million residential customers across cable and ADSL. And I got taken to a hotel in Berkshire in the UK, and it became very clear as I walked in my T-shirt and jeans that there was a big, big problem. And there was about 15 or 16 people sat around a huge table with a Nokia communicator phone in the middle, set up as a speakerphone, talking to techies in a lab somewhere. And the whole of Virgin's internet empire was down because of spam attacks. The Sun E450s and the E800s sat in their data center in Bridgend in Wales and in Wynnersh in Berkshire, physically could not cope with the amount of inbound packets. And Virgin reached out to me, a geek sitting at home unwrapping eBay purchases, to try and help them. And without signing an NDA or without having any interest or understanding of what their core business was, I spent 3 hours telling people in the room to be quiet so that I could whiteboard what the solution looked like without asking them how much they were going to pay me to fix their multi-million pound platform. And how we fixed it was by using open source. So they have a £13 million architecture built on Sun platforms. And we took 5 Linux boxes. And we put 5 Linux boxes worth about £1,000 in front of this huge architecture and put some grey lists in, IP chains and IP tables. And the platform came back up. And Virgin thought this was amazing. That Sun had been in, and Cisco, and Checkpoint, and WatchGuard had been in, and none of them had been able to get the platform back up. But by putting these 5 boxes with some flush rules and some basic IP tables rules, all the packets just bounced off. So it was like, you know, where have you been hiding? It's like, well, we haven't. Because the assumption is that Linux and open source is developed by men in pants. This is what the commercial market thinks that we do. So they think there's a guy in Boise in Idaho who's writing the latest HTML5 code, or there's a guy in Helsinki in Finland who's put down his Call of Duty game and he's sitting there developing whatever he's doing in Perl or Python. Some of it's true. I have met people. I've employed people. I am that man. Yeah, okay, so, you know, I understand where that comes from. And I'm very lucky. When I started my own company, the first thing that I did when I got money was hire all of my friends. It could have ended very badly, but all my friends were people in the open source community who had very pale skin, coffee breath, VA Linux t-shirts. I'd been clothing them in for the previous 2 years of my existence. And it gave me the ability to give people careers and a responsibility as an adult that I'd never had before, to go from just being an open source coder to being an employer. And when you start turning over $3 million in revenue, but you don't know how to write a check or to pay yourself, and you know more about code than you do about running a company, it becomes a problem. And I think a lot of Linux companies, and Matt will back me up here, during sort of 2000, 2001, a lot of the Linux companies that had taken venture capital money all of a sudden realized that there was a major problem here. They knew how to write code, or they knew how to communicate with Brian Behlendorf and the Apache guys, or Andrew Tridgell and Jeremy Allison at Samba, or Linux Care Labs in Australia, but they didn't know how to run a business. And sometimes we are not the best people to be the business drivers and the managers. And Red Hat's been through that. When I first got involved with Red Hat, there's a guy who never gets mentioned, and he's called Kevin Thompson. He was the first chief financial officer at Red Hat. And when everyone else was taking dot-com money and spending it like water with a very high burn rate, he took the venture capital money that helped grow Red Hat to where it needed to be to go IPO, and then he sat on it. He refused to let anyone spend it, so that when they came to their first and second quarter post-IPO, they still had the money in the bank to prove to the marketplace that they were fluid, solvent business. And that's how Red Hat really got off the ground, by proving they were adults. It was a big trick. It was a big trick. But it worked very well, and it was the basis and the backbone of where Red Hat could start thinking about how they would turn into an enterprise organization around 2002, 2003, when they made the decision to start thinking about a Red Hat Enterprise Linux platform. So my journey with open source really has taken me on from solving a problem for the Channel Tunnel to solving a problem that I had with the regards to, I needed a firewall, and there wasn't a box that did it, so I built my own and released it, to being able to solve real-world problems for a company like Virgin, and then repeating that at Comcast in America and Times of India in India, where I just literally replicated what we'd done with major ISP traffic. And it's enabled me to build a reputation. So security became my passion. And when I stopped working in open source, I decided that I needed to do something grown up. I needed to put a suit on for the first time in 9 years. And I worked in government intelligence. So instead of working in open source and wearing jeans and a t-shirt, I put a suit on and I worked in military intelligence, which is a huge departure. But I did it using Linux and open source. So I worked on a lot of projects in Iraq and Afghanistan. So a lot of projects around mapping, around application deployment, around imaging using Linux and open source technologies. And when you try and explain to a foreign government, especially the US government, that something's free, therefore they think it must be crap because it's free. It doesn't cost any money, therefore it must be crap. And I've often been under the assumption, I remember doing a project for HP about 10 years ago where we had to send an invoice for $1 because HP's accounting mechanism needed an invoice for Linux because they couldn't believe it was free. So there had to be an invoice for $1. Nowadays, HP are hugely involved in Linux, massively involved in OpenStack. HP Labs are a huge partner of Red Hat and also work with the likes of Canonical on projects that they're doing in the cloud with OpenStack. And they understand that really Linux has rescued that marketplace. And IBM do $3 billion a year from Linux. And Red Hat do $1 billion a year, and it's taken us 12 years to get there, and the next target is 3 or 5. So getting back involved with Red Hat, I now have a different appreciation of what open source is about. 3.5 minutes ago, the European Union in Brussels released a mandate which said that all European Union governments need to start thinking about the adoption of cloud-based services, protocols, and stacks to help reduce the budget deficits. And they're pointing fingers at Ireland, and they're pointing fingers at Spain, and they're pointing fingers at you. Very seriously, they think that you can trim 11 or 15% off your IT budgets by deploying to private or public cloud or open public hybrid cloud providers for services that your government computer systems can deploy or provision. It's an interesting, exciting concept of how we do that securely and how we do that in a model where the whole world has normally marched with proprietary software. If a government wants to acquire technology from Microsoft, they go to Microsoft. Microsoft produces them what's called a target of evaluation, a common criteria certificate, which says that it's been tested and bulletproof tested, and you know they've pen tested it, and et cetera, and it works passionately. And it's great until you put an Ethernet cable and you power it up, and then you know it falls over. But for 2 seconds, it had a certificate of conformity which allowed it to perform to a security standard. The open source movement has changed all that. About 14 months ago, I was in the White House. 7:30 in the morning, I was walking up the National Mall with the US Director of Cybersecurity at the Inland Revenue Services in the US. Andrew and I went to school together. I actually went to the same college that Matt went to as well, so another aside. But Andrew and I went to school together before he moved to America and became a naturalized citizen. He's now Director of Cybersecurity at the White House. And we had a meeting with all of the top officials in the US government about cybersecurity and cloud. And they are now thinking about how they get rid of a huge amount of their cost provisioning applications securely in cloud, provisioning applications from legacy environments into cloud-based environments. So instead of having a reliance on AIX or HPUX or even old SGI platforms, how they migrate those from platforms that cost them tens of millions of dollars a year just to support to run. 75% of US budgets go on keeping things alive, which means that you've only got 25% to keep the lights on and innovate. It's not a huge amount of money. So where do they go? They come to us. They come to the open source community. They come to the open source community to talk about Hadoop, about GlusterFS, the file system that we've acquired through the whole Gluster transition to make Red Hat storage. They come and talk to us about JBoss, realizing that things like WebLogic just don't scale or the cost of ownership is too high. And they start thinking about flexible ways of working. And then they realize that to get there over the next 8 to 10 years is going to require employing people like you, or working with partners and working with resellers who have an understanding of how to harness the best of Linux and open source. And the great thing about being a Linux reseller, it doesn't matter what brand of Linux you're selling, I prefer you to be selling Red Hat because you get to take me on site to your customers so I can entertain them. For every $1 of Linux that you sell, it is possible and achievable to make $9 or $10 of additional revenue. And I've proved this because in 2001, I decided that although I was good at writing code for Smoothwall, I was really crap at selling it. So I opened up a reseller channel, and I invited people to pay me between $5,000 and $15,000 a year to sell my product. They were my eyes and ears on the ground. And for every £1 of Smoothwall that they sold, they then sold security services, and they sold managed services, and they sold the ability to handhold and to do all the support. So they made $9 or $10 on the back of it. So it was a very easy sale. And I'm seeing exactly the same thing again now in 2012 in the Linux industry. And even more so for virtualization. For the last 4 years, VMware really has had carte blanche to do whatever the hell it wants with the virtualization market. But if you read what IDC and Gartner and Forrester are saying now, the year 2 and the year 3 ownership costs of using VMware-based technologies is hugely prohibitive in the respect that if you're a cloud provider and you stand up a cloud using VMware technologies, you have to be able to pass that back to your customer as part and parcel of how they acquire technology from you when that customer has actually decided what cloud will look like, taste like, or feel like. When you talk to customers now about cloud, very often it's a buzzword. They don't quite know how it's going to affect their business. They're not quite sure what services, applications that they can start migrating to cloud. Or worse, for resellers in this room, if you're reselling Linux services around virtualization, a lot of these customers don't actually know what they can migrate. They don't actually understand from a security perspective or from a privilege perspective what they can migrate to cloud or what impact that will have on their existing underlying IT costs and infrastructure. And I see a major gap in the marketplace for resellers and for individuals who are brave enough to be able to go and say three letters to customers who are interested in cloud. And those letters are GRC, governance, risk, and control. And I learned this working in military intelligence, that everything that I had to do, if I wanted to deploy a LAMP stack on a military base, or I want to deploy a network boundary device, such as a firewall or a gateway device, that it had to jump through specific hoops with regards to things like ISO 27001, Basel, PCI, to be able to look at governance models. Today, I can announce, there'll be a PR launch later today, that Red Hat is a member of the Cloud Security Alliance. Now, the Cloud Security Alliance is a group of 2,800 people worldwide, volunteers who give their time to generate a set of controls, a matrix, if you will, a set of controls that allow you as individuals to be able to deploy a best-of-breed cloud that beats any security architecture model that any auditor from Accenture or PricewaterhouseCoopers can dare to put in front of you. And auditors don't really understand how cloud is going to work when it comes to security. And here's the great thing. If you talk to most companies who use proprietary software and you talk to them about auditing, they think it's pen testing. And pen testing's always been done using open source tools anyway. But when you have to audit a .NET application, you're looking at lines of code. And people who deploy and develop Microsoft applications, they're not programmers. And I often get beer cans thrown at me by friends who are .NET developers when I talk to them about software development. Because Matt and I, we're used to software developers who start out with a text editor. And they write code from scratch, or they take components from other people's libraries and they fork it, because that's how open source works. Or they take a binary and they build that into their application and they compile that functionality in. Developers from the proprietary world, who've grown up with Visual Studio and Visual Source Safe, have the ability to put together libraries, functions, and calls. But they don't necessarily have a long-term future as programmers, because programmers solve real-world problems. And that's what open source does. It gives us the ability to go out with credibility and solve real-world problems on a community basis. My job is made a lot easier by the fact that when I walk onto a stage such as this and sit in front of 500-600 people, I have a million people standing behind me. It gives me a huge amount more confidence to be able to talk with clarity, to be able to talk about function, to be able to understand where open source is today and where we need it to go tomorrow. Now, I go to schools and colleges and I talk about open source off my own back, and I've done it now for 12 or 13 years. And we have staff at Red Hat and I have staff at HP and the BBC who I discovered when they were 15 or 16 years old, and I mentored them to give them the ability, or reached out to them to give them the ability to take a Linux ISO away and to be able to understand what Linux did. And one of the things that I say when I stand in front of school children aged 13 or 14, I ask them the question, who here uses a computer? And every single hand in the room goes up. Every single hand says, I use a computer. And then I ask them what the word use means. They say Excel, Call of Duty, Skype. And I say, okay, well, you're not actually using a computer, are you? You're turning your computer on and you're playing with it, you know, you're doing things with it. But the computer's actually using you because it's proprietary. And you explain to them what an end-user license agreement is, and you watch their eyes glaze over with no interest whatsoever. Open source, when you explain it to them, it sounds crackpot, it sounds lunatic, it sounds like it shouldn't be true. An example of how recently I started doing podcasts, which I think some of you have actually downloaded, looking at the figures, looking at Portugal, you're actually my fifth busiest territory. There was a technology called Pulsecaster, which is in the Fedora repositories, and it hasn't been maintained since 2007. As Matt said, very often open source projects lie dormant, And Pulse has moved forward as we've gone through Fedora releases, and there's been kernel 3.5, et cetera, et cetera. And it's been great that I can go back in there using GitHub, pull the source out, recompile it to how I want it to run on a more modern implementation of Fedora, and then contribute that back to the community so that I can record podcasts without having to power up an Apple Mac, without having to start thinking about using Cakewalk or GarageBand or, you know, an open source alternative such as Audacity. So to be able to get under the hood, and last night I was sitting in the hotel and I'd upgraded my iPad to iOS 6. And I plugged my iPad into my Fedora box and it segfaulted, because iOS 6 does buggy things to Fuse to allow it to talk back to an iPad. And the problem's still in bug track. It doesn't work with Ubuntu, it doesn't work with Fedora, it doesn't work with other Linux distributions, but I was able to get under the hood and fix it, or at least fix it on my local implementation and send the code back upstream to see if it would work on anyone else's from a beta perspective. I can't do that with Windows. And Linux allows me to solve those type of issues, but to do it on a large world order. Now, if you look at Mercedes-Benz use Linux, probably 80% of all their development for all their car platforms is done on Linux. Ford and Jaguar have been doing this anyway for nearly 13 years now. So when they send a new Ford car to the desert to do hot weather testing, or they send it to an icy plateau in Greenland to do cold weather testing, Linux is doing all of those platforms because it's the only way that they can get under the hood to modify the code quickly enough without having to have a third-party relationship with a proprietary vendor. This is absolutely crucial. The marketplace in Europe is in flux. The best thing that's happened for Linux and open source is the financial crash. Because all of a sudden, the decision makers who actually go out there and procure and buy open source software or open source services are limited as to who they can talk to. Red Hat has grown a $1 billion organization by providing the ability to have a funnel where upstream code from Fedora and from JBoss becomes a polished, shrink wrap, if you will, application which people can install and own and have a subscription which allows them to go to work. The financial crash also means that there is now going to be a lull in the amount of money that employers are going to have to spend on renewing proprietary technology. So when they come to do a technology refresh, the only thing that they can do is to talk about open source, to see how open source can solve their problems. And this is happening every single day of the week. I went to London 2 weeks ago and I picked up an award for innovation for Rev, which is our Red Hat Enterprise Virtualization platform, which competes with VMware. When I say competes, we've got 0.5% of the market and they've got 95% of the market. So it's a bit of an unequal competition. But the news and the stories are getting out there and the groundswell's getting out there, and we're starting to get some very big implementations. And it allows us as Red Hat to be able to tell a different story. And we're very fortunate as a company because we built our background on the internet service provider channel and the people who wants to have LAMP stacks and the ability who wants to have their Linux clusters with their NE2000, their Realtek cards back in the day. And it's very rare that a company gets the chance to reinvent itself. And Red Hat, really, you could call Red Hat 2.0, because with the acquisition of JBoss and the acquisition of Macara, which became our platform as a service solution, OpenShift, and now with the fact that 80% of all public clouds run on Red Hat orientated or Red Hat originated software, now you have to understand that Red Hat's got the ability to now be a new organization to drive the company forward. And while we build our company around subscription revenue from our Red Hat Enterprise Linux base, you can all of a sudden start seeing that the company who has the ability to start talking about big data and cloud is the company that's going to be part of the cornerstone and foundation of where cloud is going. And that's where Red Hat's going. But Red Hat can only do that if it's supported and it has the ability to reach out both to the community and also to a reseller channel who've got the hunger and the ambition to want to earn their own revenue by using open source standards, by using open APIs. Delta Cloud was developed by Red Hat 2.5 years ago, and it's an application programming interface which allows you to make REST calls to VMware, to Xen, so that you can write a application once and to allow it to run across multiple hypervisors, which is great because standards didn't exist. Cloud was a bit of the Wild West. And we released CloudForms in June this year. And CloudForms gives us the ability to take OpenStack or Xen or VMware or even Hyper-V later in the year, and to be able to manage your cloud across multiple cloud providers, but also to build a cloud of what you've got, not just standing up a new silo, not just standing up a new architecture built around VMware, but to build a cloud of what you've already owned. So it allows you to understand those three letters, GRC, governance, risk, and control. And if nothing comes out of this room today other than you all, one, visiting my blog, the other thing is that go and see the Cloud Security Alliance website. They have a thing called the Cloud Security Control Matrix, CCM. And it's one of the most important things that you can do to understand that a team of open source guys, without releasing any code, released a spreadsheet. And that spreadsheet is just as important as you downloading an Apache binary or downloading glibc or Linux kernel. Because from the open source movement didn't just come code, came positive instructions for you to be able to make a difference for customers and for individuals and for yourself to deploy securely against security governance or against bars or PCI, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the issues that we have when we start talking about cloud is that a lot of cloud vendors say, well, security is one of these things which stop a CIO signing a purchase order to get to cloud. The open source movement and the open source community is already trying to knock that door down by saying that if you use secure technologies such as SE Linux or SVert, which shift as part of the KVM kernel within Red Hat Linux, you can actually deploy a public cloud with those mandatory access controls and with that jail-treated controls around your provisioned environment free out of the box. It's trying to put a new world order together using open source technology. So it proves that that guy in Boise in Idaho sitting in his pants has the ability to change the world in small bite-sized chunks. You all have the ability to be world changers by utilizing open source technology. I'm a nobody, and I've proved that I've spent the last 16 years living out of a suitcase, and I've now got to a point in my life at the age of 40 where I'm looking over my shoulder at guys in Red Hat who are 24 and 25 and thinking one day I'm going to be working for them because they're brighter, quicker, and faster than I ever was at their age. And a lot of the people in this room who are aged 21 to 24, look around and shake hands with the people in this room who potentially are going to be employing you. Because if you've got the guts and the determination to understand what open source can bring to the functional running of an IT platform, but also the development of an ambition within a company to drive its products or its focus forward, then realistically, who's not going to hire you? Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.